Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Gail Seiler, together with Greta Anderson. Hello, Greta.
Hi, Gail. And hello to you, the listener.
This week has brought spring-like weather to Iowa, and that makes many of us think about plants starting to grow and folks are getting ready to put seeds in the ground. And that fits perfectly with our main topic for today's show.
Wednesday night brought Vandana Shiva to the Iowa State University campus. She is someone who is trained in philosophy and is a well-known author as well as an activist and organizer on behalf of small farmers in her home country of India and beyond. She was invited to campus by ISU's Sustainable Agriculture Student Association and 23 other organizations to deliver a message about, quote, the future of food, which was the title of her talk.
And Greta and I both attended the talk, along with about 700 other attendees. And we've lined up several guests today to discuss the lecture and respond to Dr. Shiva's comments about genetically modified organisms, often called GMOs, and her position on alternative forms of agriculture. To start off, we have Angie Carter, one of the people from the Sustainable Agricultural Student Association, who was responsible for bringing Dr. Shiva to campus.
And we have director of the bioethics program at ISU and member of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies, Dr. Clark Wolf.
Finally, we will speak with Dr. Michael Owen, a researcher in the ISU Department of Agronomy, who will provide his perspective about the issues raised by Dr. Shiva in her lecture.
But before that, we have a story from KHOI intern Jasmine Murgia. Two Iowa State students won a worldwide competition in which they had to submit an idea that would create change at the university and in the community and beyond by using the app called Prezi. And their proposal had to include how they would use social media to drive their fundraising goal.
Daquan Burnside, a sophomore in software engineering, and Mac Liu, a student in computer science, were the two Iowa State students who won this competition. And we will hear from them now.
Canvas My Campus is a competition sponsored by Tilt and Prezi, two organizations out in California who want to see entrepreneurship at the college level. Basically, it's an international entrepreneurial competition amongst college students who want to make a change on their campus. And so I guess people that entered into the campaign created a Prezi, which is a presentation through Prezi software, for the competition, and ultimately competed to win these prizes.
The main goals of this competition were to come up with an idea that would stir up some change either on campus or in the community that you are in, and then present this idea using Prezi and then use social media to drive the fundraising goal of, was it $1,000 for Tilt?
That's right. Yes, mm-hmm. So I guess anybody could raise, you can set whatever goal you wanted to. Me and Mac set a pretty ambitious goal of $1,000, hoping to, one, separate ourselves from the pack, but also because we feel like, you know, we needed a little bit more money than the other campaigns. And we were, you know, graciously funded by our peers, friends, and family to reach that goal. And ultimately, we are going to try to make a change on campus.
And could you explain, maybe for those who don't know, what Prezi and Tilt are?
Prezi is a presentation software that allows you to basically create a canvas and then move amongst that canvas. So rather than PowerPoint where you would go slide to slide, you would create a canvas and then you would create your own slides within that canvas and move interactively throughout that canvas and ultimately have more of an interactive presentation. And then Tilt is a crowdfunding site where users can basically crowdfund amongst their peers anything they want to crowdfund. So whether it be a cause for some type of philanthropy or you have a social event and you want to crowdfund for as far as dues go for your event, things like that, just to raise money. And basically how Tilt works is you set a goal, and if you hit that goal, you tilt, and no one's charged unless you actually hit that target.
So how does it feel to have that much support?
It's amazing, honestly. I had numerous faculty as well as staff here at Iowa State, help fund me as well as, believe in my vision for change on this campus, as well as friends and family back home that really want to see me succeed and see me make a difference in my community, and it's a great feeling.
Okay, and so how did this journey begin? How did you find out about Canvas My Campus?
I got an email, actually, from Prezi, and, you know, I've been working on this idea for about a year and a half, and you know, I guess it came about as the greatest opportunity that I could have used for this idea. And so, you know, I thought this was perfect. I might as well get started. You know, you really can't lose anything by attempting and submitting something. So, I talked to Mac and said, hey, I'm going to apply for this competition and see if we can win. And I think we had a great shot, and we won. So,
okay. And why did you reach out to Mac?
It was actually, we're both George Washington Carver scholars, and we actually sat next to each other every single day in physics. And it was a little ironic that I had personally been looking for a developer to help me make this because I don't have the programming skills, but also finding somebody else to split the workload. Starting a business and creating a mobile application is something that just can't be done alone. And so we kind of found each other through a leadership retreat here on campus, and we both realized we had the same aspirations career-wise and ultimately college-wise, and he loved the idea, so we got together, and everything's, you know.
Okay, and history. That makes sense because you are a sophomore in software engineering, and then Mac mm-hmm. is a freshman in, what was it, computer science.
That's right.
So what else did you learn throughout the process about yourself or even about each other?
I think I'm just kind of realizing that, you know, regardless of your age or your ability, you can get anything done. You can do whatever it takes as far as your goals. You can always reach what you want to reach. And I think finding somebody like Mac who works really, really hard, as well as finding somebody that complements your weaknesses and you complement for their weaknesses, it was really cool to kind of find somebody that I can work really well with. And I think if anything I learned throughout this process, it would be determination and hard work along with patience can create an amazing feeling.
Okay, and then so speaking about goals and, you know, inspirations, what drove your passion for this project?
Personally, I'm always a problem solver, and I think many of us are problem solvers as well, but we often don't take the initiative to make a change in our community. And I feel like this is a change that one needs to be made because, you know, many organizations that host events in our area either one spend money in the wrong places or spend too much money in the right places. And I want to be able to create a product that's both cost efficient as well as really engaging for their supporters. And, you know, Mac and I are working really hard to create this product to be released this fall so that these organizations who host events in our community will ultimately be able to, you know, drive people into the door and ultimately have an amazing experience at their events.
Okay, so what does this change? What was your idea for Canvas My Campus?
So, initially, I realized that many organizations in and around campus have a really, you know, really tough job getting their events as well as reaching their supporters. So, I mean, you might see around like chalk on the ground, people writing on chalkboards. You might see people send out mass emails, which cost a little bit too much. Not to say that DMU does a wonderful job marketing these events, but I feel like there's an untapped market as far as providing a solution, marketing, and as far as a tool goes for these organizations. So I guess users in the community, people that would use the application, would ultimately be able to select organizations in their area through different categories and subcategories. They can find out what organizations they're actually interested in and then select them. And when they support these organizations, they get invited to their events. So rather than seeing it on a flyer or seeing it in an email and forgetting about it or having to write it down when they see it somewhere, it'll all be with all this information will be within an application, and they'll be able to ultimately at a moment's notice find out what's going on in their area.
Okay. And have you started developing the application?
Yeah, so we're about a little over halfway done with it. Obviously, you know, that's a pretty solid estimate as far as time goes, and it should be out in the fall of 2013, an iOS application. And then I'll be working this summer as well to create an Android application to supplement that. Something that we're really working toward. And I think, you know, Mac's doing a great job balancing his family, his current internship at Rockwell Collins, and his development amongst this project. And we're really excited about releasing this fall.
Okay, so you will be releasing this fall. So for the incoming freshmen, they already have a solution to maybe if they come from a small town, coming to a bigger area and then knowing where to go to have you know, for their interests.
Exactly. So when you come to campus, whether it be your dorm floor, your favorite organizations as far as students go, or different ISU programs and athletic events, you know, when they host events, you'll get invited and you won't have to go searching for it.
There were two teams that won. You and Mac won by public vote, and then there was another one that was staff pick. So how does it feel to have all these supporters?
It was actually amazing. I think I would rather have won by public vote than staff vote, because I feel like our application, the fact that the public was willing to back us, as you know, fund us as well as vote for us in this camp competition to make us to the finals, and ultimately win, it's amazing to feel, you know, that someone actually believes in our idea and that people want to see us succeed and want to see other people succeed and be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that that's the end goal, is to be able to make a change and to actually be able to affect a change in our community. And that's, you know, if the community backs us, then ultimately, you know, it's going to come full circle.
Mm-hmm. And that definitely does say something, because it's the people who want this idea. They're the ones who are agreeing with you and saying that, hey, yeah, we do need this application and it would benefit the community for the better. So let's talk about the prizes. What did you and Mac win?
Prezi EDU Pro accounts for everyone that has an iastate.edu extension on their email for about a year. And so that'll happen either at the end of this year or next fall. Something we're really excited about, to be able to bring that prize back to Iowa State, as well as Mac and I won a trip out to San Francisco to meet Prezi and Tilt and get advice from everybody in their network.
Okay, and could you maybe expand on what Prezi EduPro is and what type of services they offer to ISU students and faculty?
So Prezi EDU is an extension of the Prezi software. Basically, they create ed tech for different organizations, institutions in America as well as internationally, to better serve their students so that they can ultimately present their ideas and their findings through the most interactive software possible. Prezi does a wonderful job of allowing and empowering students to create amazing presentations and ultimately, you know, stand out from the crowd.
The type of work that you want to be doing after graduation?
Yes, I would actually like to do this kind of work before graduation. So, you know, my goals are to start a business here this coming fall, hopefully become profitable by the time I'm a senior so I don't have to go work for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to go to work every day knowing that, you know, I'm making a difference in my community. I feel like that's the kind of work that I would love to do. And I think entrepreneurship and software are the ways to do it.
Okay, and then so you plan to do this through this application, or will you be developing maybe something different?
I would love to do this. I feel like there's a lot of potential with this idea. It's very scalable. There's a lot of different marketing features, which I won't get into now, but there are a lot of different things to enhance people's experience at an event, especially social events, and really being able to ultimately know what's going on in their community. But I am also interested in the musicians, and especially independent musicians, hopefully be able to help them in some way in the future as well. So whether this is the first of many projects or, you know, the first and final, I look forward to the challenge as well as being able to grow and help people.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you for, you know, sharing this with the KHOI community.
Thank you. It was a great opportunity. You guys are awesome.
Oh, not that.
That was Jasmine Merguia, a student in the School of Journalism at ISU and an intern at KHOI, who has been covering stories that focus on ISU students. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City Ames.
We turn now to the central topic of today's show, the visit of Vandana Shiva to the ISU campus this past Wednesday. Dr. Shiva is a well-known critic of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, and of industrial agriculture in general. GMOs are organisms whose genetics have been altered not by the traditional methods of crossbreeding, but by insertion of one or more genes from completely different organisms. For example, a tomato could have a gene from a fish, and in fact, such a tomato exists.
Here in Iowa, genetically modified organisms are all around us, as the most commonly planted types of corn and soy in our fields are varieties that have been genetically modified and produced by Monsanto to be resistant to the herbicide Roundup. These varieties contain a gene that make them impervious to the most common herbicide, glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup.
Vandana Shiva's area of expertise is the cultural and economic effect of bioengineered crops on farmers in the rice belt of her home country, India. India does not allow genetically modified foods, but BT cotton, a type of cotton in which a gene from a bacterium has been inserted, quickly became 95% of the cotton crop in India after it was introduced. In addition to her activism in organizing resistance to genetically modified crop systems, Shiva has helped farmers in India organize for the right to save seeds, a right that they had before the patenting of bioengineered seeds began.
And we have several guests with us to discuss the issues raised in the lecture and other concerns related to these topics. First is Angie Carter, one of the students in ISU's Sustainable Agricultural Program, who brought Vandana Shiva to campus. Welcome, Angie.
Good morning, Gail. Good morning, Greta.
Hi. We also have a member of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at ISU and the director of the Bioethics Program, Dr. Clark Wolf. Dr. Wolf focuses on public policy issues and has been researching and writing about GMO issues for 7 or 8 years now. Welcome, Dr. Wolf.
Thank you for having me.
And later we will be joined by Dr. Michael Owen, a researcher in the Department of Agronomy at ISU.
Angie, let's start with you. Dr. Shiva mentioned that the conversations that brought her here started over 6 months ago. So you've been working on this visit for a long time. What would you say made you want to put that kind of effort into bringing Vandana Shiva to Ames?
At Iowa State, we see very clearly that the focus is on industrial agriculture. From the Grant Wood mural at the library where tillage begins, where you see the breaking of the prairie, to the Monsanto Student Services in Curtis Hall, the focus has all been on one type of agriculture and one type of what they see as progress. And we think it's really important that we have a diverse knowledge base of sustainable agriculture students, that we're learning about many different types of agricultural systems, and we feel that often it's hard at Iowa State to find those voices that are champions of different systems of knowledge, that are understanding of cultural consequence of technology. And so we thought that by bringing Dr. Shiva to Iowa State, we would be able to elevate some of these questions that often are not asked and not discussed at our public university.
Dr. Shiva commented specifically about Iowa State University in her talk when she discussed the transgenic bananas that have been engineered by a researcher in Australia to contain high levels of beta-carotene to help with the development of vitamin A in the body. She noted that some Iowa State students will be participating in research to study the effect of these bananas. The research is being done by a faculty member in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Transgenic bananas is a complicated issue that has many dimensions. Could you summarize the key points that Dr. Shiva made about this issue for the listener?
Sure. About a year ago, I was actually invited to participate in this study. I didn't participate because I was taking my prelim exam at the time, but I wish that I had because we would know a lot more information. So far, the university has not been very responsive in sharing many details about this study, but we know that 12 women were invited to participate in eating this banana, that they would be paid $900 to do so. We don't know much about how the study originated, how it came to Iowa State. We do know that it's being funded by the Gates Foundation, but the questions as to who will own this knowledge once it's created, how it will benefit people beyond just carrying this vitamin that they could very well find in other foods, those questions have not been answered. And so that's why on March 25th at 8 p.m. in the Pioneer Room at the Union, we are hosting a critical dialogue to try to talk some more about, you know, what does it mean to have a study that we have these questions about, what we don't have the answers. And that talk will be called The Transgenic Banana, Ethics, Implications, and Alternatives. And so we'll be trying to understand more information about what are the cultural consequences of such a study. Dr. Shiva made the point very clearly that, you know, this is a question of biosafety. It's a scientific question. We don't know the impacts of this banana upon people. We don't know the impacts about having this type of food in our food system. And she said in her talk the other night that the denial of biosafety is, in fact, itself unscientific, that proceeding with the systemic blindness in which we're not talking about the larger impacts of this technology is very dangerous. And she cited historical examples, you know, going back to World War II and Nazi Germany, of times when the denial of consequence of technology was very, very dangerous. So science in itself is not an objective or a safe process. You need to have discussions about the ethics related to the technology before you proceed. And we just want to know more about what the discussion has been around the ethics of this technology that they're developing with the banana.
I will say that in preparation for this show, I contacted Professor Wendy White, the researcher who is conducting the testing of the bananas at ISU, and she declined to be interviewed. Have you found anyone at the university who will participate in your dialogue on March 25th about the bananas?
Interestingly enough, it wasn't until last night. So we had over 700 people were at Vandana Shiva's talk at the Memorial Union on Wednesday evening. And last night we received an email. Thursday evening we finally received an email back from the College of Ag and Life Sciences. And so we have been trying to have somebody from the college come and talk about the study. We've been contacting them for over a month now. Originally we were trying to encourage Dr. White to come to speak about why she's engaging in this study, and she declined. And then we had contacted the dean of the College of Ag and Life Sciences, Wendy Winterstein, to see if somebody else from the university could possibly make it to speak to this study. And last night they emailed and offered to send actually quite a few people to come to our talk. So we're now in discussion with them. We hope that somebody from the College of Ag and Life Sciences will be able to come to speak to the relationship with the Gates Foundation, how it is this study came to find its way to Iowa State, what the benefit is for the public good, because we are indeed a land-grant university.
Okay, let's bring Dr. Clark Wolf into the discussion now. Dr. Wolf, previously you told us that you were at the talk the other night and, you know, had some reactions to it. From your perspective as a philosopher, could you explain your relationship to what she discussed in the speech?
Well, I'm interested in many of the issues that animate Vandana Shiva. I think we all should be interested in issues of social justice and improving the position of people who are disempowered. I have a very different perspective on many of the issues that that Shiva examined. And I do think that it's important in looking at Shiva to recognize that she's an activist. She's interested to promote a certain point of view. There's nothing wrong with being an activist. It's a valuable role. But I think when we're addressing work by an activist, it's very important to follow up on claims that are made and evaluate them in terms of the evidence that's available to us.
Well, Dr. Shiva's critics have pointed out her lack of scientific credentials, and she has an undergraduate degree in physics and a PhD in philosophy, but no degree in biology or agriculture. So were there any particular claims that she made that raised a red flag for you?
Well, I don't think that lack of a science degree disqualifies a person from having opinions on matters of deep public concern like this. On the other hand, I also think when one makes scientific claims, those need to be checked against the data. So one of the claims that she does make has to do with the introduction of GM cotton to India. So she makes the claim that the introduction of GM cotton has caused farmer suicides in India. But if you look at the rate of farmer suicides in India, it's been stable over the period when GM cotton was introduced. Now, that doesn't immediately mean that she's wrong. There might have been, in the absence of GM cotton, a radical reduction in farmer suicide. But it does call into question, at least, the claim that that causal relationship is in place. It seems to me there are many sources of human misery in the world. I actually join Vandana Shiva in thinking that, corporate industrial models of agriculture are inappropriate in many, many parts of the world, and that we need to be looking for environmentally and humanly appropriate forms. On the other hand, I think we need to do that with our eyes open, looking carefully at the evidence that we've got available to us.
One thing she did talk about quite a bit in her speech was the need for rigorous scientific studies, particularly in the area of biosafety. How does biosafety fit into your field of bioethics and her mm-hmm. perspective?
Well, again, I cannot claim to be an expert in biosafety. It does seem to me that we have an obligation to ensure that products that are introduced onto the market are safe. We have an obligation to ensure that that agricultural practices that we introduce are environmentally appropriate. And I absolutely think, I agree with Vandana Shiva that it's appropriate to have scientific studies that test and examine those safeties.
And that it's our ethical responsibility to do that? Would you say that as well?
I do. I absolutely think that's an ethical responsibility.
And that's one of the concerns that inspired our bringing Dr. Shiva to campus, actually, is because we see that a lot of the research at Iowa State around agriculture is funded by corporate interests. And so there's influence, of course, in that. And often scientists talk about, oh, activists questioning scientific knowledge must be biased. They're clouding the science. But how much does it cloud or influence the science when the people who are profiting from the knowledge you're creating are funding the science that you're doing? And so when we have these corporate names across our university, when they're endowing professorships at our university, those are the same people that are then advocates for GM technology, like Ruth McDonald at Iowa State. And I would argue that really clouds their credibility to be able to speak about these issues. And so that's something that we're just trying to open up the conversation.
Okay. For those who are just joining us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We are discussing the visit of Vandana Shiva to campus on Wednesday night. Vandana Shiva is an activist who has raised concerns about the presence of biotechnology, especially in developing countries, and how it affects the cultural and economic systems there. One issue that she brought to the fore on Wednesday night was the ownership and patenting of seeds and other life forms. Is that issue, ownership and patenting of life, something that is addressed in bioethics?
Absolutely. There's a huge literature on patents and on, well, one of my areas is the philosophy of law, and I'm especially interested in intellectual property law. So this is another area where I think Vandana Shiva is onto something. Right? I do think that there are ways in which patents can provide an inappropriate kind of control over the intellectual property that they protect. And there are ways that patents can go wrong. When patents work right, they're designed to instigate innovation and instigate the developmental of technologies that are valuable. When they go wrong, they can result in privatization of what should properly be in the public domain, and they can result in making technology development more difficult because in order to develop new technologies, you need to solve a whole range of patent problems. And these have been problems in the seed industry and problems in agriculture more broadly.
Yes, and again, she noted that she had worked very hard to create seed banks with among local groups, as many as 120, she mentioned, on the ground there in India. And she also worked on a law that helped to establish the right of farmers to save seeds, and these would be publicly owned seeds. And evidently that right had been threatened. Perhaps you could both respond to this question. In her talk, Dr. Shiva frequently connected issues of food safety and sovereignty with the future of democracy in the world. Can you help us understand that connection?
Well, I do think food sovereignty is another place where Vandana Shiva is absolutely on an important issue. Let me give an example. We may not think of hunger and the devastation after the earthquake in Haiti as being caused by Iowa, right? However, it happens that Haitian agriculture went into decline partly because of low corn prices from the U.S. As a result of activities in Iowa partly and activities from which we all may have benefited, Haiti lost its ability to generate its own food for itself. Its agriculture systems were devastated. After the earthquake and actually around the time of the earthquake, corn prices in the United States rose dramatically. The effect of lack of food sovereignty in Haiti is that initially they lost their indigenous local agriculture, and then when food prices rose globally, they were unable to feed themselves. Food sovereignty is a crucial issue. And I think Shiva is right that nations and individuals and communities need to develop the ability to feed themselves. We can't rely on a global food system to respond to the needs of the poor.
And this is something we hope to talk about on March 25th in our transgenic banana discussion, which will be in the ISU Pioneer Room at the Memorial Union on campus. Because in the question of this transgenic banana, the argument some are making is that by making a transgenic banana, we can deliver beta-carotene and iron to people who are undernourished who need these things. However, we know there are many other sources already existing naturally in the environment, in the food system, where people can gain these sources of iron and of beta-carotene, where they could grow them themselves. We could support local markets already in the biodiversity there. Of course, that would mean that the Gates Foundation wouldn't get to look like a savior and that the university would not be getting this money for the study. It would mean that corporations would not be profiting over finding these hunger solutions. And so looking at it through that lens, you know, you become very critical about why is this research going on? Why is it needed? Why are we not instead looking at ways that we can help rebuild local infrastructure, where we can help improve soil fertility, where we can help people develop locally types of seeds that work in their own areas, you know, to work as Vandana Shiva has done through seed banks, through local food systems. That's what empowerment looks like. But we're so quick to think that anything that is not a silver bullet solution is somehow unscientific or it's wrong or it's not progress or something. And that's because we've bought into this feed the world mythology. But I think if we question that, we see that we're not feeding the world. We're actually engaging in a lot of agri-colonialism, that we don't have a democratic food system. If instead we were focusing on helping, you know, develop indigenous seed banks. We were working to help value local knowledge. Most of the farmers in the world are women. Most food is grown by women. If we were working on empowering women and making quality of life for them better through different things, we would be able to strengthen the food system and feed more people. Yet that's not the focus of studies like this, and I would ask why. And that's not a question about the scientific process. That's an ethical question. We need to have space for that discussion at the university.
I believe she also compared the issues around the transgenic bananas with golden rice as having some of the same raising some of the same concerns. Would you agree with that and explain the similarity?
Absolutely. It's another situation in which we were looking for a technological fix to a social problem. And technology is great. I'm not anti-technology, and I think Dr. Shiva would say she was not either. But you don't proceed with technology without thinking about the implications and the alternatives to it. That's part of the scientific process, is to question. And so I think you heard in her talk the other night that she was talking about their very successful grassroots effort to stop the rice, because that was not something that they saw as culturally appropriate, that it was appropriating indigenous knowledge for the profit of companies. And so they're looking for much more locally based and democratic solutions so that people are controlling their own food supply. We're not looking to corporations. We're not looking to expert knowledge from the university for all of the answers.
Dr. Shiva used the phrase the monoculture of the mind, which I thought was an interesting phrase that and maybe you can give us your insights on how what that means to you or what you think of that phrase.
Is that for me? I think it's true that forms of technology come often with a perspective. The example I sometimes like to use is sitting on a tractor or a backhoe. Trees look very ephemeral and temporary when you're sitting on a backhoe. They look strong and powerful and permanent when you're walking in a forest. So I think it's true that technologies we adopt bring with them a perspective that informs the way we look at the world. And I value the idea that we should examine our technologies not just for what they do for us, but for the way that they inform the way we experience things. I favor, however, a both-and solution in many of these cases. I have to agree with Angie. Biotechnology is not a silver bullet. It's not going to feed the world. However, there's nothing that is going to solve all of the problems, right? And I think that we need many different kinds of solutions. Right now, we are in a period of environmental transition where farmers in Bangladesh are experiencing unprecedented floods, unprecedented environmental change. It is going to be valuable for farmers in that area to have flood-resistant crops, because I don't think that the crops that they've traditionally grown will stand them in good stead. In Central Africa, I think it's going to be important to have drought-resistant crops. I absolutely think that it's appropriate to look at all of the other solutions, other sources of beta-carotene, for example. Transgenic bananas, golden rice, they're not going to be a solution to the problem. But I think they might be an element of a solution, an element of a broader solution rather than just part of the problem.
You kind of mentioned the when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of thing. And so when you have this amazing technology of being able to introduce a gene from a different species, the problem of vitamin A deficiency, it looks like that thing that you can solve.
So as we come to the end of this segment, do you have any last thoughts that you would like to share about the sorts of things that Dr. Shiba talked about?
I was so encouraged to see there were 700 people there, Iowa State lecturers said, and the energy in that room was so great because we know that we need to have, as Clark has said, that we need to have discussions about, you know, it's not as if it's all one way or all another way. We need to be able to have a scientifically based discussion that is also critical to talk about, you know, what solutions we can use. And so she was really inspiring because she validated the fact that we know at our university it's very biased one direction, that we do have this monoculture of the mind. And so I think everybody was just so happy to hear somebody say what we've all felt internally and have internalized as faculty and as students at the university. And we know that together we can be much more creative in our science to address these things in ways that are ethically appropriate, that are culturally appropriate.
And Dr. Wolf?
I'm pleased that Vanda Nashiva is able to speak at a university like this one. I don't agree with many of the things that she says, but I think it's very important, as Angie points out, to have a variety of voices. And it's incredibly important when there is a standard way of doing things. It's important to have critics speak and to raise objections to the ordinary way of running things.
Okay, well, Angie has to go. Thank you, Angie, for being here.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Angie Carter and Dr. Clark Wolf, both from ISU. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Was music by Arthur Lee Land, a musician in Colorado, was once in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, Story City Ames, where we build community through communication. We have a new guest in our studio now. We want to welcome Dr. Michael Owen from the Department of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Dr. Shiva's lecture the other night focused on the issue of bioengineering, and a lot of claims were made. We felt we wanted to hear from people in the field to hear their perspective, and we reached out to representatives from Monsanto and Biotechnology Industry Organization, BIO, centered in Washington, D.C. They were not able to speak with us today or yesterday, but Dr. Owen, you were gracious enough to agree to come in, and we appreciate your willingness to do so. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Dr. Owen, can you describe the kind of research that you do at ISU to get us started?
Yeah, very specifically, I am by training a plant physiologist, and by vocation, I'm actually an extension weed scientist. I work with the now some 80,000, 90,000 farmers in Iowa, all of whom have weeds and all of whom have expenses attributable to weeds and all of whom are experiencing losses of production attributable to weeds. And so I help them manage them, both herbicidally, of course, mechanically when appropriate, cultural and biological as these strategies come forward. Very clearly, early in the discussion about genetically modified organisms, which the original traits were specifically for pest management, and the first and the one that is most widely adopted not only in Iowa or in the United States but globally is for weed management by providing the target plants with the ability to withstand glyphosate, which is a herbicide which previously to that was widely used but non-selective. And so that clearly that part of that became a major component of the discussions with farmers as to how to best manage their weeds.
So your area is weeds, and some of the research, but not all of the work you do, is around genetically modified crop.
It includes, you know, right now, out of convenience, most of the experiments that we do, whether we're looking at different herbicides or different tillage systems or different crop rotations or whatever, typically includes the use of the genetically modified corn or soybean cultivar, simply because it becomes that much more easy for us to manage our research.
Can you also give us a general sense of what other kinds of research are being done at ISU in this area?
Well, there was a statement that was made, I believe, by Angie that that corporate research is very important in Iowa State University, and certainly some of the work that we do is important. But as it turns out, in the College of Agriculture, we have the highest monies coming in from external grants of any of the colleges. I believe it's somewhere around $60 million every year and has been increasing over the years. Only 7% of that money comes from corporate donors. I myself receive money from a number of different companies. And I myself, over my career of more than 35 years, have been taken to task by the industry, Monsanto and others, because of some of the positions that I've taken on some of the proprietary products. But as far as specific research, we have worked with some of the companies. I know that in the plant breeding area, they work closely with a number of the seed companies, not many of which are located here around Ames. Most of the different herbicide companies, for example, will do work with them in one fashion or another. And they have they provide suggestions, but they do not provide specifics that we need to react to. We take their recommendations, we interact in discussions, and then we decide what is most effective as far as experiment or treatments or whatever to support Iowa agriculture.
We're going to get down to weeds right away here.
Now, let's be very clear about weeds and weeds because of some of the recent legislation.
Oh.
let's not confuse
not
the
weed,
issue, please.
Plural.
Yes.
Plural.
No,
we're
marijuana
not...
is a weed, but is also not the weed in which we do research.
One issue that Vandana Shiva raised on Wednesday night was amaranth, the prevalence of herbicide-resistant amaranth growing in cornfields here in Iowa and also cotton fields in the South. And she attributed this incursion of amaranth to the overuse of herbicides or perhaps just, one kind of herbicide again and again. Do you agree that that might be one of the causes?
Well, absolutely. But her suggestion that this is a genetically engineered problem is absolutely wrong. From the perspective that we look now at herbicide-resistant weeds, which is a significant factor, I participated in a committee with the National Academy of Sciences to specifically address some of those issues. We've had a number of summits that were, again, sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences in Washington to discuss herbicide resistance and the implications of herbicide-resistant weeds on production agriculture and so forth. To say that it is a direct cause of genetically engineered crops or GMOs, if you will, is absolutely wrong. It's not a trait problem. It's absolutely not even a herbicide problem. It's a management problem. It's how the tool is used in agriculture.
So in advising farmers, what do you suggest to them as a way to deal with that, with the herbicide-resistant weeds?
The one thing that was suggested, and I have to admit that I did not attend, nor was I even aware of the presentations that Dr. Shiva was at, is the fact that agriculture is a business, and agriculture, like all businesses, has integrated vertically. And I find it rather interesting that we in agriculture are being vilified from the perspective that, you know, they talk about corporate farms and that's bad. But yet when we start to look at the number of automobile manufacturers that existed at the turn of the century versus those that are now, you know, they're undergoing the same process of vertical integration that agriculture has undergone. Right now, in agriculture in Iowa, arguably the most important agricultural state in the United States, although California would suggest otherwise with the Central Valley, but you know, nevertheless, we have about 80,000 farmers, and this has declined every year for a number of reasons. And what we find now is agriculture is developing a bimodal response. We see more small farmers, and we see more larger farmers. Now, the discussion as to what is a corporate farm and not, you know, becomes more of a legal perspective, not just, you know, whether it's a family, because most of the large farms that I know are indeed family farms. They have just chosen to, you know, become a corporation for tax purposes and things like that. But, you know, you have to recognize that time management is one of the biggest issues that everybody has to address, and certainly in agriculture. And they have chosen, they, as in the farmers, have chosen specific tactics to manage agriculture that is most time efficient for them, but also most profitable. And so the decisions that they make oftentimes are very difficult decisions. They certainly have sociological implications. Very obviously, they have economic implications. And as it turns out, in some instances, they have environmental and ecological implications. And this is the case with the evolution of resistance to herbicides. I look at my Charles Darwin coffee cup that was so graciously provided. And I've spoken about herbicide-resistant weeds since the beginning of my career in Extension in 1977. And we have gone through numerous, if you will, evolutions of evolutionary occurrences. We have resistance in weeds to essentially all of the herbicides that are now commercially available. Why has the pigweed become a major problem? Twofold. One, pigweed and others are adapted to the agroecosystem that we have established. We have gone from where, you know, when I started, moldboard plow and significant tillage was done on almost all of the fields in Iowa, to now we are using a conservation practice. And a weed like the amaranthus, in this particular case, Amaranthus tuberculatus, or if you will, water hemp, is well adapted ecologically to exist in that system. And in truth, the system, the rotation and the tillage is the most important selective factor in which weeds are going to be important in production agriculture. And then the ultimate selector is how you control them. And obviously in Iowa, most of the fields are being treated with herbicide or herbicides. And of late, since, you know, about the mid-90s, we've been using glyphosate as a selective product because of the genetic modification that companies put into the crops. You do enough things enough times, and if that thing, whatever it might be, is effective, Mother Nature will allow adaptation. And that's essentially what has happened. So you ask, what do I tell growers to do? I tell them, well, whatever it is that you've been doing, don't do that anymore. Modify it.
Getting back to some of the discussions in our previous conversations with Angie and Dr. Wolf, they talked about the need for a diversity of solutions to solving many of the problems that, to use your phrase, our agro-ecosystem faces at this point. So am I sensing that you would agree that bioengineering is not the be-all and end-all, that we are going to need a diversity of possible solutions?
Well, we have had the, you know, end-all, be-all solution many times in agriculture. And in each case, adaptation occurs. That's just the nature
the
of
nature
the game.
Of the nature of the nature.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the thing is that growers, again, are in a business and they make decisions and they have to look, unfortunately, in many instances, more short-term than long-term. And they make decisions based on their sound judgment. And he or she may decide that this is how I'm going to manage weeds, and that is what they do. Like many people, strike that. Like all people, they're not going to fix a problem until the problem exists. And unfortunately, in the case of weeds and the evolution, and it's not just weeds, also some insects, but this happens because of the selection pressure that's brought forward by the tactics that growers use. This evolutionary process happens almost at lightning speed compared to what Charles Darwin and Russell Wallace described over 150 years ago in their respective areas of study, the Galapagos Islands and also in the Indonesian archipelago.
Can I just say, I think there's a social problem as well involved in this case, because it turns out this is a context where what's in the interest of each individual farmer, if they do it, turns out to be contrary to the interests of farmers in general in Iowa. If all of my neighbors are not using glyphosate, my using it will not result in the development of the resistant weeds. But where everybody is adopting the solution of using the same pesticides and at high levels, that's the circumstance where we get the swift evolutionary response that we see here.
Absolutely. And one other thing, it's kind of interesting because one GMO technology, for example, BT, if I use BT but you don't, you actually profit from that because there's less bugs to go around. But your point about the weeds is exactly right, which is why I now have a NIFA project that is investigating. It includes both rural sociologists and ag economists and others trying to determine, okay, what are the trigger points? Why do farmers make the decisions that they make? What can we do to address those, and what sorts of incentives can we bring forward, whether they be a stick, which is translated into government regulation, which, of course, everybody favors, or some sort of a carrot, which would be monetary inducements and so forth. Interestingly, Monsanto has actually provided monetary inducements to diversify weed management in their proprietary crops.
Okay. Well, this is a fascinating conversation, but I'm afraid we have to bring it to an end and wrap it up.
Yeah, but my coffee's not done.
You can take it with
Thank
you.
Thank you.
It's been really great to have you both here and Angie as well, and to hear these different perspectives. And we appreciate the fact that Dr. Owen stayed and contributed to the conversation in this second part. Thanks very much. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Owen from the Department of Agronomy at ISU. And finally, we have the live music listings for this week, courtesy of Belinda Merritt.
Thank you, Belinda. Sorry you can't be here with us. Looks like somewhat of a slow week due to spring break, but here's what's on tap. Friday, March 13th, the bands Screaming for Silence, Bombardier, Through the Darkness, and Hollow Point will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. Gimmick will be at Crossroads Tavern in Kelly, Iowa, and the Burning Sensations will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler. Saturday, March 14th, the bands Monday Mourners and Fred Love will be at DG's Tap House. Saucy Jack will be at the Lucky Pig, and Nova Labs Unplugged featuring Dr. Murdoch, Moon Rabbit, Secret Freedom, Instance, Jess DeWitt, Strong Like Bear, Triggerfish, and Rockets of Desire will be at Blue Stem, formerly Zeke's. One of these days we'll just know it as Blue Stem on 3329 Lincoln Way.
Thanks again to all of our guests here in the studio with us. This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City Ames. If you like the show, tell your friends or tweet about us. A podcast of this show, along with resource contact information, will be available on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team, please call 292-2878 or stop by the studio at 410 Douglas. Your role as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.